This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. The 287G program is a program that allows police to act as immigration and customs enforcement officers, which means they can detain and arrest undocumented immigrants. Critics say the program leads to racial profiling and that it makes immigrants fearful of reporting crime in their own communities. 287G is quietly being phased out, but it's still in effect in six counties and one city in North Carolina. Yesterday, the Wake Forest School of Medicine and the Latino advocacy group El Pueblo hosted a forum on the impact of 287G on the health and health access for Latinos. Joining us to talk about that is Scott Rhodes, a professor at Wake Forest School of Medicine, and Florence Simon, who is health program director at El Pueblo. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Scott, tell us what prompted the study.
What prompted the study, there's a lot of concern in North Carolina about the role of these immigration enforcement policies and their impact and a variety of issues, right? I do a lot of research with specifically around health, and so we wanted to really get a better understanding of how these immigration enforcement policies are impacting the health and well-being of Latinos in North Carolina.
So what did you find?
Wow. So it was pretty profound, actually. We found that – so what we did, we looked a little bit at North Carolina vital statistics data. So we looked at – they have really great data around prenatal care and pregnancy for all races and ethnicities in the state of North Carolina. It's very current and up to date. So we looked at comparing Latino women to non-Latino women in North Carolina because we wanted to determine whether they were seeking care at the same rates as non-Latino women.
And what'd you find?
We found that they seek prenatal care later, that they also have fewer prenatal visits, and Latino women are actually less likely to receive any prenatal care than non-Latino women.
So that's a finding. Florence, is there a way to correlate that to immigration policy?
Well, it was interesting. One of the things that we expected to see that we didn't see, but we expected to see that there would be a difference in whether women accessed the health departments for prenatal care in the 287G counties versus the counties that didn't have 287G. What we realized is that there was really not a statistically significant difference. But one of the things that we also realized is that people really don't live within county boundaries. And so one of the things that we saw a lot is that many of the people that we interviewed. So in this study, we conducted six focus groups with about 65 individuals and conducted 17 in-depth individual interviews. And so we realized that everybody talked about fear. So it doesn't really make a difference whether you live in a 287G county or you are in a non-287G county. There's also secure communities, which is another policy that's actually affecting immigrants. It's increasing immigrants' fears.
Tell us about that one, secure communities.
So secure communities is it's an immigration policy that actually is now going to be implemented in all 100 North Carolina counties. And the idea is that when an immigrant person is formally arrested for a crime or offense, that local law enforcement will report that person's information and will get them fingerprinted and will report that information to FBI and ICE. And if there are any outstanding charges, the person could be deported.
So if you're arrested, you can be fingerprinted. If you're fingerprinted, you send it to immigration if you think that if you have any suspicion. And, of course, we already have seen the reports on the very high, the big difference between the number of arrests made for routine stops among Latinos
right.
versus the Anglo population. So
right.
all of that's been but here's a question I have for you, Scott. So you talk about access. In other words, Latino women access prenatal health care later and less often than the general population. But what about outcomes? Does it make any difference in terms of health outcomes?
So Latinas in our state tend to have pretty good birth outcomes in spite of these barriers. But the issue really becomes is access to services. So services, healthcare that is needed. We learned a lot through the second phase of our study, which Florence described, about people not getting the subsequent care that they needed, children not getting access to medications that they needed. So there's something going on that folks don't have access to services, and later some negative outcomes.
Well, talk about, Florence, if you can, whether or not there's a general fear of, say, clinics.
Yeah, it was actually really intense because at El Pueblo, I'm in charge of the health programs, and we end up working a lot with promotoras or lay health advisors, and we work with peer educators. So we hear a lot of the stories of the fear that people have, but it was really difficult for me to hear when we were doing this in six different areas of the state, in six different counties, hearing the same stories over and over again about people being panicked, people being paralyzed with fear, people having anxiety, and just the idea of getting in the car to go to a clinic knowing that most likely you're going to be profiled because you look Hispanic, you look Latino. People talked about that a lot. And so people talked about not feeling safe and not feeling that they could really drive to a clinic unless it was an emergency. Many times they focused on, we will go to a clinic if it's an emergency for one of our children. That is the priority. But if it has to do with us, it's not. We will try to figure out other ways of coping. So either by trying to rely on medications that we can get from friends, that we can get from somebody in our home country, or trying to rely on natural remedies.
You've also heard stories about people who indeed were afraid to get care for their children.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And so it was interesting because people talked about they would be willing to take a risk sometimes for their children. But I think it really depends on what the situation is. Yeah. But yes, you're right. I mean, we heard that a lot.
Scott, well, Scott, it seems to me one of the difficulties in determining outcomes, too, is if people aren't accessing the system, you don't have any records, so you really don't know with any degree of certainty what the outcomes are and how to compare them.
Right, right. And I think it's really important to note that this delay of seeking care, we weren't just interested in prenatal care. Those are the data that we had available that were reliable. So this is sort of a proxy for how Latinos are delaying necessary and needed care over time.
Well, let me ask you if that's a fair proxy, though. I'll ask you and I'll ask Florence both, because is prenatal care considered, there may be a cultural difference. Maybe prenatal care is not an illness. It's not something that we seek medical help for in this particular community. I mean, is there a cultural difference between wellness care and health care when someone has a medical need, Scott?
So in our research, we really do see Latina women as the only ones with any type of access to services. A lot of our work with Latino men tends to indicate that these men don't seek services for anything at all. So they may pull a tooth on their own, or we've had all types of examples of that type.
And I think what's hard for me is that I feel that because we don't have that data, it doesn't mean that we don't have the stories. To me, the stories provide that data. The anecdotes that we hear on a regular basis about how people feel paralyzed, people are scared, people don't really know how to deal with how to access the services because they're afraid. They're afraid that they will be profiled. They have no idea if at the clinics they will be asked to produce an ID. They don't have a license. And so that was very evident in our stories.
Go ahead, Scott.
So, and I think that's an important issue that we really wanted to systematically collect qualitative data to be able to say, are the stories that community-based organizations, advocates are hearing, is there something to that? And what we learned is there's a lot to that. So what we all sort of hear that's happening, the fear, the profiling, it's very much affecting the Latino community.
287G is being phased out, Florence. Does that have any impact in the community? Do people say, oh, don't worry about it now, that thing's going away?
No, because Secure Communities is replacing it. And so the other thing that we realized is, you know, again, people don't live within county boundaries. And so a lot of the people that we talk to might be construction workers or people who were doing housekeeping. And so people have to drive from one county to another. So Secure Communities will affect everybody in every county.
Scott, I know that your report and research didn't focus on this, but I wonder if there's research out there that looks at the health effects of perhaps the anxiety and the stress that these kinds of programs create if people are reporting this kind of fear.
Right. There have been studies to sort of – they're just beginning to look at the constant fear and the constant anxiety that and what that produces related to immigration policy. But it's still – you know, we're still trying to figure it all out, really, and quantify that.
And I think one of the hardest things for us to hear was the effect that it's having on children. And so not thinking about adults – and I'm not discounting the importance that it has on adults, but just thinking that a child, you would assume that they would be dealing with other issues at that age, that a four-year-old wouldn't have to worry about whether his or her parents are coming home at the end of the day because they might be picked up by ICE on their way home.
I wonder, too, about the modeling. I mean, if it becomes a kind of a cultural fact of life that we don't go to the clinic for whatever reason and the kids grow up in that environment, it becomes harder even if conditions change for them to believe culturally this is a place for us to go.
Right. And we did hear a lot that the children are picking up the fear of the police and this sense that you really shouldn't be seen. You really shouldn't be out in public. And many of the parents talked about not taking the children to parks anymore and just making sure that the children just went to school and then came back and stayed at home just to provide a safer environment for them. Yeah.
Scott, I know you've also done research on Latino men and HIV. Tell us about that.
Right. So we have been doing a lot of work with Latino men and HIV, especially in rural communities. We've really learned the Latino community has not had sort of easy access to services or folks coming out and really helping them understand what services are available and how to access them. So we've really worked hard to set up programming based on community member priorities that help people get access to HIV testing, access to preventive materials, prevention materials, and those types of things. So we've been working in North Carolina since about 2001, and have had lots of successes working with within the Latino community.
How prevalent is HIV/AIDS in those communities?
So just overall, African American community has been disproportionately impacted by HIV, and Latino communities have been the second group, really, and then whites sort of below. So Latinos have been disproportionately impacted. About 20% of AIDS cases are within the Latino community. When they don't, you know, if you sort of looked at the percentage of Latinos in the United States, that doesn't really add up.
Right. And so you talked about effective means of gaining access and education. What are they? What works?
So we are really committed to lay health advising approaches. So training community members who are natural leaders to work with within their social networks, to work with their friends, work with their soccer teammates to make a difference. So really working with folks who are leaders to help their friends.
What are the barriers? I mean, is it strictly access and fear of going to clinics, or are there other sort of cultural barriers to AIDS prevention?
So, you know, I think that a lot is just not knowing what resources are out there. Part of the reason our team has had a lot of success with HIV prevention in Latino men is we haven't had trouble getting into that community, recruiting, getting participants. It's been pretty easy in the sense that that folks are here to better their lives. And so they want to know other ways, not just, you know, it's not just a job. It's actually, you know, having a better life overall. So people are really willing to work with us.
Florence, are any of the techniques that Scott is pioneering, and I think you're having some success, the Center for Disease and Control has already recognized some of your efforts. Is that right, Scott?
Yes.
So is there any way then to use some of those techniques in the general population to talk about other health effects and allowing people to or encouraging people to access health, Florence?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we focus on as well is training lay health advisors. So it's promotores de salud to make sure that they provide information about the importance of prevention and information about resources in the clinics, but also that they can provide trainings for our communities to make sure that they hold agencies accountable. I mean, I think that's one of the things that many people are fearful sometimes, but it's holding agencies, the police department, the sheriff's association accountable for their behavior and for how they're implementing their policies, because usually the way they're implementing their policies are not the way they were designed to be implemented.
Well, if people are afraid to access services because of their immigration status, would they really be willing to hold these agencies like the police accountable?
If we do it as a group, we're realizing that people are willing to do that. We saw that in Alamance County.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Florence Simon is Health Program Director at El Pueblo, a Latin community advocacy program in Raleigh. Scott Rhodes, a professor at the Wake Forest School of Medicine. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. If you want to comment about the show or hear an archived edition, go to the website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is directed by Alex Granados and produced by Sean Wen, Nicole Campbell, and Dave DeWitt. Haley Sklut is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.